Hello, and welcome to Her Music Academia, the podcast. I'm your host, Lydia Bangura. I'm a singer turned music theorist turned podcaster. And I do all three of those things in a music PhD program at the University of Michigan. So I do music research, I perform locally, and I use the show to have conversations with other musicians, all about their musical endeavors, whether it be in performance or music research, music education, pedagogy. And this month, we're continuing our series for Women's History Month. Today on the show, I have a conversation with Dr. Candace Bailey, who's a professor of music at North Carolina Central University. We talk all about her musical upbringing and how she got into historical musicology research. We talk about her time and curriculum and syllabi at an HBCU. And we talk all about her most recent book, which was just released in 2021, titled Unbinding Gentility, Women Making Music in the 19th Century South. It's a fascinating book. I highly recommend you check it out. Make sure you check the show notes for the links to all of her work. Without further ado, here's our conversation. All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of the podcast. We are continuing our series of guests for Women's History Month, and I'm so excited to introduce my guest today, who is a current professor of musicology, right? Not me not double-checking. Musicology. Yes. At North Carolina Central University. Today on the show is Dr. Candace Bailey. How are you?
I am great. How are you, Lydia?
I'm good. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak to me today. I normally start off each episode talking about how I met the guest or became introduced to their work. And you actually reached out to me this summer, which was so kind of you, to ask if I would be interested in visiting NCCU for a really cool lecture series that you guys put on. So could you tell us about that?
Sure. I am the Neville Distinguished Professor, and as part of the use of funds, I decided to bring in guest speakers. This is only a two-year appointment. I've just gotten reappointed. So this is the third year of speakers that I've brought in. And it's been really important for me to bring in Black scholars for my students, because NCCU is an HBCU. So I want them to see that they can do this too, that they can be a part of this field. And it has had a tremendous impact on the students who I had two students last year get full rides for graduate school in ethnomusicology. I've got two students, one student applying this year, one student applying maybe halfway next year. Anyway, and several more coming through the pipeline. So it's been just, I can't tell you how impactful it has been for people to see some of the really wonderful, wonderful people that I've brought in, like Naomi Andre and Tammy Canoodle, coming into the classroom, Horace Maxiel. The male students have really responded to, wow, you know, seeing a Black theorist. That it was like, this is something that they hadn't thought about or knew existed. And so I've been using the money from the professorship to take students to conferences and to bring scholars in.
Well, that's a really great use of funds, and I'm so glad that I could be a part of it, you know, amongst a really rich list of scholars. I know that that would have been really impactful for me because, yes, I, during my undergrad sequence, never had theorist who, even during my master's as well, so my undergrad and my master's, never had a theorist who wasn't a white man. And even during my undergrad, I only had one professor of color in 5 years of, you know, I'm from Arizona, so
I'm in North Carolina.
But so I imagine, like you're saying, that does have a really big impact on your students, and I'm really excited to visit the campus.
Oh, we're excited to have you,
It's going to be so fun. So let's start off talking about you and your background in music. So if you could inform me and the listeners a bit more about where you're from, where your family's from, if you are from a musical family, if there are other musicians in your family, and your early experiences with music.
Okay. I am from rural eastern North Carolina, grew up on a tobacco farm, and it's not a place where there's a whole lot of classical music, and there's not a lot of, well, just not a lot of music in general, to be honest, where I grew up, because it's quite rural. But my dad played saxophone in a dance band and was the local band director in some of the middle schools and high school. So he wanted me to take piano lessons so I could play piano for his band. So I was quite a disappointment when I said, no, I like classical music. I don't want to do that.
Wow.
Yeah. And I guess even before that, though, I was late coming to music studies, but I wanted to be a historian first. That was my first want. And then I started taking piano lessons, and I was pretty good at it, and got into UNC Greensboro, which is a big music school in North Carolina, and I got a degree in piano performance. But I wanted to be first a music theorist, but
Really?
they had gotten rid of that undergraduate music theory program the year before I got there.
Whoa.
Then I thought, well, I started playing harpsichord and doing a lot of with early music, and I said, oh, maybe I'll be go to harpsichord, or I'll be an accompanist because I really like that. And so I thought about those two things and decided to I auditioned as a both in harpsichord performance and wrote applications for musicology and just decided to go with musicology. It just suited me better, I thought. And so I did and went to Duke for my master's and PhD. And I worked on 17th century English keyboard music, which kind of came out of that harpsichord early music. I really enjoyed the puzzles, the unknowns with early music, because it seemed with the 17th century particularly, there was so much we yet had to know. So that's kind of my background and where I went with that. Right.
Yes, and as you said earlier, you had kind of an early interest in music theory, but didn't really have the opportunity. So then why did you end up doing musicology rather than music theory?
Well, it just happens to have, in my undergraduate, there were advanced courses in music history, such as medieval music, Renaissance music, Baroque music, and there were not advanced courses in theory and analysis beyond one course, which I took as an undergraduate, the graduate course, but that was it. There was no, I did take modal counterpoint. But there was no outlet. There was no one teaching theory beyond analysis, right?
Sure.
Just straightforward analysis and not what to do with it. And I had all these opportunities to work with facsimiles of original scores in music history courses. And that just caught me. You can do theory in music history, right? So I thought, oh, this is really what I want to do. Let's go that way.
Tell us a little bit about your time at Duke.
I went to do with the intention of doing a dissertation on early music, but Baroque music. And they were just starting a performance practice program at that time. And I was one of the first people to be admitted with that program. Not that I was doing performance practice, but I was taking courses that were very related to it. And that was all lovely. I was in graduate school at the time when we started making that switch from, or at the time when archival studies kind of seemed to go out of fashion, and the new musicology of the 80s was coming out. And I was, my dissertation and the work I had done was in that old vein. I had a great time at Duke. I enjoyed my time at Duke. I have learned a lot since then. I started out with English 17th century music, as I mentioned, and I was following what other people had done. And so you've got the score A and you've got score B, and score A has an eighth note here, and score B has a quarter note here. And so which one came first, and what was the stemma for how these things went? And I was doing that for a while. And then I started thinking, this matters why? Or how practical is this? And I started applying a more practical way of looking at 17th century scores, knowing that they were all playing basso continuo all the time.
Right.
Why did I assume that they would play this exactly as it was on the page? I started to question, why is this way? And why would they have played it that way? And, you know, some of the last papers I did in 17th century music were kind of going in that direction. And I started wondering, I was always dealing with women's sources, or mostly a lot of women's sources, and thinking about how it actually happened. You know, Christopher Small's musicking, how did this actually occur? Mm-hmm. When it was heard, how was it heard? And I kind of came to the conclusion that it didn't matter exactly which score had this or that, the other, because they were going to improvise on it anyway.
Mm.
A lot of it was going to be improvised. Or that was a possibility if you had the skills.
Right.
So I started making a turn to thinking about how music happened.
Yeah.
When it happened. And that took me, with my beginning work on 19th century music and women, where, of course, we don't really hang it on composers, right? That history doesn't hang on composers.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you do approach it that way, you miss pretty much everything. And it became important to me to think about who's doing the music.
Yes,
I can tell you that Brahms wrote this piece in this year and it's because he knew Schumann and da da da. But that's two people, you know.
Right.
Where are the bulk of the people who are listening to this kind of music, who are buying this music, who are performing this music? Where are they? What do they know? What do they think about it? What do they do with it?
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of, you can see how that kind of was growing out of what I was doing in the 17th century and really fit well with what I ended up with in the 19th century, looking at what we call binders volumes, which are bound collections of sheet music, and trying to think about who this person was when she was playing this and who this person was playing the same piece or playing something. I mean, you know, just all kinds of questions started coming out of the archives, because I love the archives. Archive rat. I thrive in them.
We'll have to talk about that later, because this semester I have two archival trips and I've never done one. And
lucky you.
I'm going to the Library of Congress for the first time.
I've worked there a lot. But, you know, just trying to look at music, and it's informed how I now teach music history.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't teach music history at all like it is in most places. So anyway, yeah, that's kind of the trajectory of how my work has gone from looking at source A and source B to where it is now.
Yeah, fascinating. Thank you so much. And this is a perfect segue, because I was going to ask a bit more about your teaching and approaches to pedagogy and everything that's happening at NCCU. So tell us a bit about what you teach or anything that you are experimenting with in the classroom.
Oh, thank you. I am really been experimenting a lot in the past 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I teach all the music history classes, and the students are required to take four. And the way I have devised them is the first is American music. It's kind of like your introduction to music history. And I was doing mid-ran as the first course for years. I've been at Central 25 years.
Hmm.
And people didn't do well. Okay. My student body is not familiar with mostly what a Roman Catholic is. So how do you start? I mean, so it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, American music, that's more familiar. We'll start with that. And then I do the regular sequence in the second, third semesters from medieval to now. And then I do world music in the last semester, contemporary world music.
Mm-hmm.
I started revising the American music course first. And I do that course from the perspective of Black Americans, because it's at an HBCU. It doesn't mean that's the only people I talk about, but you know, I think it helps students have a frame to see music history. So I focus on music by Black composers. I play videos with Black performers, and I assign readings by Black authors for that course. And a lot of times it's the people who are brought in who they're reading, right, for their assignments. And that's been really cool for the students to make those connections, because the people have been so lovely in offering to help with graduate school, you know, things in the future, et cetera. So I teach music history, the first one, from that perspective. Then I thought, well, how can I teach a more inclusive sequence? Mm-hmm. So what I do now is I start the medieval with a kind of global look. I go into the Renaissance and I have John Blank, who was the black trumpeter at the court of Henry VIII. We've got a new thing I was just assigning on Lusitano, a black composer, you know, late Renaissance. And when I teach opera, we did a big project last year on Dede's Amandede's Morgiane, which still remains in manuscript, although I'm in the work process of transcribing it. But that's the opera we learn. And if it's a symphonic work or an art song, the one that the students learn is going to be by a black composer, as well as Schubert, right? So Margaret Bonds instead of Charles Ives. Mm-hmm. 20th century symphonies by black composers, operas by black composers, instead of the traditional canon. I was very nervous. I'm still a little nervous that I question, am I teaching my students what's expected when they go and take a diagnostic exam?
Sure.
Graduate school? Mm-hmm. Because as one of my students asked, I think it was Tammy Cronodal, but it might have been Fredera Hadley, why do I have to go to a PWI to graduate school to study black music?
Mm.
Right?
Oh, I have so much to say about that. That is the question.
Mm-hmm. So preparing students for what PWIs expect them to have,
yeah,
the repertoire they expect them to know, is that what I need to spend my time doing? Or teaching them the concepts through black examples, mm-hmm, if possible. And I'm going with the latter, telling my students who I know want to go into like musicology, ethnomusicology, that you're expected to know a lot more and you may have to go back and take another class as an undergraduate class in graduate school because you haven't been taught how to analyze a Brahms symphony or how to, you know, go through and complete Wagner opera. But what, I mean, we talk about Wagner, but they don't have to know a Wagner opera, you know? We do other things and talk about things from different perspectives. So that's one of the tensions that I'm dealing with myself right now. Mm-hmm. Am I teaching them what they need to know? I know there's certain things they have to have for the Praxis 2 exam for the music ed teachers, mm-hmm, right? There's certain standard music history things they're supposed to know with that. That's the biggest challenge that I face. That and the fact that there's absolutely no textbook that we can use.
Sure.
Absolutely no textbook.
Yeah.
And the scholarly articles I assign often are above them. Right, mm, they're reading that at that level.
Right,
we can just start to get some sense of how people are talking about Porgy and Bess. Right, mm-hmm, how is she talking about Porgy and Bess? Right, it begins to make a difference in the way students see themselves in music history in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a really good point about like there being no textbook for a curriculum like this. And so I imagine it's a lot of, you know, heavy lifting for you in terms of putting this type of curriculum together. I talked about on a different podcast episode that this past semester was my first time like creating my own syllabus for something. I did it as like a final project. And I was like, oh my God, this is so hard. It was just one class. I can't imagine doing a whole sequence.
We teach 4-4.
Yeah. Wow. Ooh. Ooh, thoughts and prayers, everybody, for Candace.
I teach graduate courses in jazz research and writing.
Oh, wow.
We have a master's in jazz performance.
Oh, that's exciting. So
it is exciting. And we now have an online program. But it's really tough because I do each year want to respond. I have the student do a project in class where they just tell me how it's going. What could I do better? What would you like to see more of? What didn't work? What did work? And I do try to change my syllabus every year with that. But you're right. It's time consuming.
Mm-hmm. I imagine. Yeah. And also to your point about like, what are we preparing students for? especially knowing that if they want to get a PhD, they're going to have to end up at a PWI. And mm-hmm. so, like, I remember running into this tension a lot in my master's. I did a master's in voice, and so it was a slightly different context in the performance context, but I remember during my master's starting to ask music theoretical questions about, like, you know, oh, why do I perform it this way? Or why is it that the cadenza is always this way? What if I want to do this? And mm-hmm. my professors, my voice professors in particular, really steering me towards, like, because this is the way it's always been done. And if you go to an audition and you sing it differently, you're going to look goofy and you're not going to get the role or whatever. And so, you know, I started to wrestle with, like, oh, I thought I was here to, like, learn to, like, yes, become, like, a better singer and, like, grow my technical ability, but also to, like, learn to think about music better or think deeply about music, ask critical questions about music. Like, I thought that I was becoming, like, a music thinker, or maybe I was doing that, and my professors were like, that's not what we're that's not what we're actually trying to do. And so I start asking all these questions, and they're like, this is not that's not what we're doing here. So, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of what are we preparing our students for, are we, like you're saying, preparing them with multiple different perspectives on music history? And I also, again, love your focus on not just telling a history of composers, which is, you know, kind of the standard way to do music history, or just exceptional performers or whatever, but really diving into the everyday experiences of music, people's interactions playing music and singing and writing music, even if they're not quote unquote exceptional, but, you know, everyday interactions with it. And so providing such a well-rounded perspective on music history, I'm sure your students really appreciate, but I understand that tension of, like, are they going to then fail their entrance exam to blah, 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 blah. Right. That's complicated.
Right. That's my biggest fear. Mm-hmm. And I hate that I have to be beholden to a test, mm-hmm. which was probably devised 10 years ago.
Yes.
But I mean, I can't change everything.
That's true. That's true. Again, you're only in charge of your own classes and curriculum. But again, I bet the students are really thankful for such a wide range of perspectives in relation to music. So before we get to talking about your book, I have one last question. I'd love to hear, this is my favorite segment on the show, it's the advice segment. And I would love to hear just anything, thinking back to your time in grad school and as a junior scholar, if you have any pieces of advice for grad students and junior scholars about reading academic texts for the first time, learning to read, writing for the first time, or teaching for the first time.
Oh my goodness, you must have had a crystal ball and looked into my head. Okay, so this is kind of, this will be revelatory for a lot of people who know me, if they're listening, but they don't know this. So I struggled mightily in graduate school and the first few years afterwards. Because I couldn't read scholarly articles. I didn't know how to read scholarly articles. I just read it and thought, okay, this is it. And I didn't know how to think about them. And I was winning awards for my writing in composition class. And my music history teacher was telling me, you write horribly. You don't know how to write. You've got to do better than this. And I could never figure out the disconnect. And suddenly, as things have changed and we've gotten more, I don't want to say colloquial in the way we write music history, but we've gotten less academies.
Okay.
Makes sense. Suddenly, people are liking my writing. Or suddenly to me. And people are talking about my writing. So, and what this is, I've learned, and what I would advise people to think about is, I'm sure, I have recently been diagnosed with ADHD. At 60.
Wow.
And with a very extreme range of the H of the hyperactive. And this, I now know, affects the way I read.
Mm.
Right? So the fact that I can't just read easily through something, I have to take it apart and I have to do it slowly and I have to do it several times. And then writing, I've learned how to organize. And for me, writing big things like the book, I literally print, then I take each paragraph, make sure everything's on one topic, and then I write on the side what the main topic is. And then I cut each paragraph apart, and then I put all the things that are on this topic in this pile, and all the things are on this topic in this pile. And then I go back and look at the piles and put them in order.
Wow.
Instead of just writing, because I start, my ideas change. And sometimes I don't even know where I'm going until I'm writing towards the end. It's like, that's what I'm talking about.
Right.
And revise it with that. So it's not a process that I learned at all in writing classes, and nobody was teaching writing in graduate school.
Mm.
But now I know, going back and looking at my old work, I can, that's bad. And I know why, and now I know how to fix it.
Okay.
Because I've have some workarounds, but it took me a long time to work those out by myself.
Mm.
And I know there was a session on ADHD at the last AMS, but I wasn't able to be there. But I'm very interested to see how that develops.
Sure. Yeah.
But I have learned that is a driving force behind my own reading and writing. And I would urge people, if you think that you might have an issue with this, and again, nobody suspected it with me until I was almost 60, to look into it. Hmm. Because I think that can be very helpful and would have been helpful for me early on, because I received some very hurtful comments back from various folks, and I didn't understand what the problem was.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing that and for, drawing attention to how hard it can be in grad school and in your early career to develop your own process for reading and writing. I do feel like I kind of fell into this degree and was like shell-shocked, right? By like, wait, I have to read like multiple books a week? Like, I don't even know how to, and even encountering the language for the first time, trying to connect ideas for the first time, come into class and, trying to like lead a discussion or something and being like, I don't, I barely understood what I read. And so all of that I imagine is definitely a more common experience for people that are getting into the academy. I also thought, when you were mentioning, the early feedback on what you were writing, my mind instantly went to like, oh, is the feedback about like your writing isn't formal enough? You kind of hinted at language. And I was like, oh, is that the common trope of if your writing is clear and easy to understand, that it's not like complicated and, it's not smart enough my mind went to like, is that misogyny? Ew, I don't like that. But
I never wrote with a lot of really big words.
Sure.
Because I was taught that wasn't the best way to communicate.
Right. Because you want to be clear.
Right. But I wasn't making connections. And there were connections in my head, but they were not, I didn't see them, that they weren't on the paper.
Mm.
Right. And that's why I have to see it, take it apart, put it back together by seeing it.
Yeah.
Which is not how anybody told me to do it. So,
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing. I learned so much about my own process by hearing other people talk about how they encounter their reading and writing practices and how those develop and how it really does take a lot of time. So thank you again for sharing all that. So let's go ahead and talk about your recent book, which is called Unbinding Gentility: Women Making Music in the 19th Century South. So you did kind of allude to earlier how you ended up kind of getting into this work, but could you tell us a bit more about the progression from your first book on this topic? I don't know if it was really about this topic. Yeah, I'm like, was it? What is the progression of you getting specifically into this research?
So my first publications were in 17th century music.
That's right, 17th century.
And a couple of editions that I did that. And around 2000, I just started wondering what my great-grandmother's musical experiences were. And then I thought, I'll look at Southern women's experiences. Mm-hmm. And it grew from there, from the 19th century. That's how I got into this field. I've moved back. I live in my grandmother's house now. I renovated it. And so, this is who I am. And so nobody's talking about this. So let's look at this. And I was surprised to find out how little people were looking at it. And in general, around the country, women's music. And so I started doing research on that, looking for women composers. Mm-hmm. Because that's what we talk about, right? We talk about composers, and that's what And then I was like, oh, we're not finding them. Ooh, not finding a lot of this. What's going on? What do I talk about? So that led me to looking at women's culture and how music fits in women's culture. My first book on this topic was in 2010, Music in the Southern Belle.
Yes.
And I did that. I love doing this research. People offer me stuff all the time. It's like, oh, we have this collection. Could you come look at it? Oh, you're talking about this. Can you come look at this? Da, 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 like that. So I did that. And then it took me a long time to write the next book, I thought, which is The Unbinding Gentilly. Well, there was another book in between on Charleston, Charleston Bells Abroad, which I wrote in a year because I had all that information right there. And then I had been working on this book for so long. I had a contract with Illinois, and Laurie Matheson was fantastic in helping me shape the book because I had it shaped quite differently. I started off by doing state by state by state, and that didn't flow. And then I had a year at the National Humanities Center, and I was able to take some really serious time to think about how to organize. And it finally came together. What, 12 years later, 10 years, 11 years later, after the first book, not counting the Charleston book in between. Right. So, you know, it really took a while. Mm-hmm. But I have had so many bits of information, you know, because there are very few people, women from this period, we have their whole story.
Right.
And it took a while to kind of cull and draw from that mass of information to come to some of the conclusions and ideas that I did.
Right. Yeah. And I really, you know, appreciate going back to what you mentioned earlier about the archive. I really appreciate that, you know, you're really investigating the archive in a particular way. That is to say, like, just because we can't find these women's whole stories, or just because we're coming up short on women composers or women musicians, doesn't mean that they didn't exist, right? It just means that they weren't formally archived or wasn't formally written down. We have to figure out ways to fill in those gaps. And so, you know, you're up against a whole host of challenges there. That was really interesting to see you, you know, the different ways that you are navigating that.
Yeah, it's like playing with puzzles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very exciting. So let's first just define a couple of these terms in terms of the title, how you arrived at this title, and what is gentility? How are you engaging with that term?
This is a little bit embarrassing because the title itself, The Unbinding Gentility, was suggested by the marketing department.
Oh, okay.
Because I had something, you know, boring like women's music in the 19th century South or something like that.
Okay.
And they said, no, we had to have something
catchy. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, but the book was always about gentility because that was, I was trying to figure out, and this is what took me so long, is how do we have a rich planter's daughter who's had every advantage from Charleston, a poor white woman from a farm in eastern North Carolina, a upper middle class free black woman in Natchez, an enslaved woman outside of Atlanta, all playing the same pieces, essentially.
Yeah.
Right. How does this happen? There's no way that we look at the 19th century United States that accounts for this homogeny.
Yeah.
These different structures, social structures.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I thought about it, I landed on gentility because I had the book, The Lady's Guide to Perfect Gentility, and it included At the Pianoforte. And I thought, yeah, you know, everybody is learning music. Some learned it because they liked it, but they're also learning it because it's what was done if you have a certain level. Ironically, in my own upbringing, I took piano lessons. I had art lessons. I had dance class. You know, it was not that far removed from what I saw was going on in the 19th century. And when I looked at some of the ways these women use the music, they're all using it in the same way. They all have the same rules. They don't perform in public, right? They perform at home, but they have to be modest. But they're playing, you know, some of them were difficult than modest music, but That's another little subcategory. So to me, it was this pursuit of this ideal of being a genteel person, no matter what your social class was, mm-hmm. that kind of covered all of these experiences.
Right. And so, like you're saying, binding all of these different, races of women, class, is this overarching kind of theme of the performance mm-hmm. of gentility, and that happening through music, and that being, a marker of a certain class or a certain, ideal of womanhood, developing ideals of womanhood at that time.
Yeah. And I think unbinding has also got several plays on it. There's the way you just used it, but it's also the fact that we have these binders volumes.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. And so we're unbinding what that meant. And then there's the literal binding of the body, which Elizabeth Morgan talks about. Some other folks have written about the unbinding of the body. And I talk about it in Music and Southern Bells. You couldn't have played some of these things if you were wearing your best outfit. And you were
you couldn't because it was so restrictive. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So unbinding is a play on several different ideas.
Okay. The best titles are, they have multiple different facets to them. Yeah. And so I also, your point about women also not performing in public, because again, that kind of goes against the gentility performance, was that it was this like demure performance at home that kind of symboled, and even the setup of the home, having a pianoforte, all of those being kind of status symbols
right.
that could help your social standing or, were cultural markers of something. And so I think there's also something to be said again about the larger field of music history, prioritizing performances in public, right, in the concert hall, these kind of formalized ways that we talk about performance. Those are the ones that we end up talking about in a traditional music history sequence. When we're not talking about composers, we're talking about exceptional performers who performed in public.
Right.
And of course, that being a space that is, more serious or more masculinized, right?
And more white.
In terms of who has access to those spaces versus parlor music, maybe being more feminine.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, like you point out in the book, oftentimes the music is the same, which is so yep. interesting.
Yeah, I was totally amazed at that. And that's something that people have made assumptions about in the past. And the evidence bears out that that was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They're playing these massive fantasias on opera themes, which is what Liszt was playing. It's what Thalberg was playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also love your earlier connection to musicking and that whole concept. Another concept that I was really thinking of while I was reading certain parts of the book was William Chang's Loving Music Till It Hurts, and the kind of dignity that oftentimes historically we have afforded music over people and over personhood. I'm thinking of a particular chapter in there. Dr. William Chang, please come on the show. Please let me talk to you about your book. I love that book. And, there's a certain chapter in that book where he is talking about the music of enslaved Black people, the music of Jews during the Holocaust, like the fact that participating in music making could often differentiate you from other folks that weren't musicians and give you like an advantage in terms of like literal survival. And so the fact that we're not, those are situations in which people who are being dehumanized are humanized through the practice of music. Mm-hmm. And so this felt like an interesting kind of parallel to that in terms of the types of capital that is connected to music, in terms of like social capital, cultural capital that these women are pursuing through this performance.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you can see that with the Johnson family in particular, because both parents had been enslaved and, they become very wealthy by 19th century standards up into the 1850s.
Mm-hmm,
and of course, the children all take music and they take French.
Right. Yes.
What do you mean in Natchez?
Right. I'd also love to talk about there's, parts of your book that are dealing with what you're calling scientific music. So talk to us a little bit about that and how you're engaging with that term.
Well, scientific music is a term that's used a lot in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And I find it, what really started striking me was when I found people advertising that their music program, their teachers teach music scientifically.
Hmm.
It's like, as opposed to, and one source I found kind of spelled that out. And, you know, we won't learn things by rote. We will learn to read the music and we will learn it. That particular place also taught composition and theory in the 1840s, 30s, 40s, 50s. So that kind of said to me, okay, so it does mean something specific. And then I found a review of a girls' school program where they said, oh, they played these scientific pieces, and then they played these pieces.
Mm.
Said to me, okay, there's this person at least in this town understands scientific music to be this as opposed to this. And the non-scientific were just dance cotillions.
Mm.
And the scientific music was not anything particularly, it wasn't, you know, sonatas by the great European composers, but it was, you know, it could be the delicate flower in the morning by, you know, local composer, but it wasn't just a utilitarian dance piece. But more specifically, what I was able to discern is that it generally meant being able to read music and music from notation.
Hmm.
Was, again, one of those social uplifting things. I play music from reading it. You only play it by ear, you know, that kind of a thing.
Okay.
And saying that you could do it scientifically gave you some cachet. And this went through the entire period that I look at in the book.
That's really fascinating. You also have a chapter in there that's specifically about the music making of women of color and is kind of confronting that stereotype or kind of a narrow-minded way of thinking about Black enslaved women making music or Black free women making that music during that time of just being, you know, passed down through an oral tradition, which is definitely true and definitely a big part of the music making at that time. But also there were women of color that knew how to read music. And again, just because there's kind of a lot of that missing from the archive doesn't mean that it didn't actually happen, right?
Well, that's so much in what you just said. The missing in the archive thing is so frustrating because I know there were a lot more women doing this. I've had some discussions with some scholars, and Naomi Andre was the first person to really put it to me. He said, so you know, these women are not exceptional because they are what everybody who was at this class and this amount of, you know, was doing. We just haven't found a lot of the evidence yet.
Yeah.
Right. So not to be amazed that this was going on, but and this is something then that kind of informs my teaching is to try to teach this as, no, this was happening. This is what people were doing.
Mm-hmm. Teaching it as the norm rather than the exception. Norm. Yeah.
Right. You know, anyone who's, and I do this with, another paper I have coming out where I've been through some photographs from the 1870s in New Orleans or images that and there are all these women of color because it's New Orleans and they're very richly dressed. And my point is, you know that these women had piano lessons. And you know that these women had bound volumes just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Just common sense. I like to think that I take a common sense approach to musicology and what must have happened. Okay, we haven't found the evidence yet, but come on, you know this is what had to happen.
A common sense approach is amazing. I need a shirt, I need a sticker, I need a water bottle, a mug, a common sense wow. AMS, are you listening? Yes.
And some people, some prominent folks have teased me about that. So we're going to have to rewrite the whole history now. And I'm like, well, I think we should. But yeah, just, you know, as I said, common sense tells you that these, that a lot more people were doing this. And they're not always going to be the young white women.
Absolutely. Another thing that was coming to mind while I was reading about, you know, the experiences of these women of color making this music, it made me think of Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham and her whole theory of the politics of respectability. When she originally wrote that book, I've read parts of that book, and I know that it's specifically speaking about Black women in the 20th century, so it's not the same time period.
Right.
But I feel like the performance of gentility really goes hand in hand with respectability politics in terms of presenting yourself as a respectable person, as a person who commands respect through the performance of these, you know, kind of highbrow or these cultural signifiers of gentility. And so, yeah, that just kept coming to mind as I was reading this. I was like, oh, I feel like, you know, these two theories are really in conversation.
It's interesting you say that because I've got an article coming out in the American 19th Century History Journal, which is a British journal about American 19th century history. And I specifically quote Higginbotham and the culture of respectability or respectability politics and the Johnsons and bring them together.
Oh, yes. Okay. I can't wait to read it. Yes. Yeah. That just felt so like prominent to me. It was like, oh, yes. Like ideals of womanhood developing around how one carries themselves. Obviously, like gender politics or the solidifying of gender roles has always had, you know, a particular performance associated with it. And you can track that change over time in terms of how it changes. But this feels like it's really, you know, solidifying class markers and signifiers into the performance of, you know, again, presenting yourself as a respectable person, that being tied to like morality, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So I can't wait to read it. Yes, I called it. Is there anything else that you want to mention? Anything that you're working on or anything that you're looking forward to?
I am doing a lot of things in expanded directions of where I've been in the past couple of decades. So one of the things that I'm doing that is quite interesting, quite fun, is looking at how these binders volumes translate across borders. And I have been working some in Vienna and some in Hamburg with a collection there. And I've been working with some collections in France. And I have been working with a collection in Chile.
Ooh.
And I am in connection with scholars in Mexico City and some other places in Latin America. And we are trying to put together an exhibition that's going to be in Santiago de Chile in late July of this year on women's accomplishments, women and music in Chilean culture. And these binders volumes will be the exhibition in the National Archives, which is kind of fun. I'm interested in looking at from New Orleans South, how that is connected as a something we can see as one thing and how that's different from north of New Orleans. And so that's kind of a different way of looking at the women's question. And then I'm also working on Edmond Dede's Mujeres. Really excited about that too.
And that is going to do it for this episode of the podcast. Thank you so much to Dr. Candace Bailey for being on the show. I'm so thankful to be connected to her and the great work that she's doing. Again, make sure you check out Unbinding Gentility. All the links to everything that we mentioned are in the show notes. If you wrote a book about music and you want me to read it, or if you make music and you want me to listen to it, if you have any recommendations for a musician that I should talk about next, please get in touch with me. Send me an email at hermusicacademia@gmail.com. Or go to my website, hermusicacademia.com, and fill out the contact form there. I'm always looking for something to listen to next. Thank you for rocking with us every Monday in March for Women's History Month. Until next time, thanks for listening.